Welcome to Tampa Bay FM's Synergy Connection, where life as you currently live it can be transformed into the life you've always dreamed of. Understanding your synergistic connections is the pathway to your emotional, physical, spiritual, and mental wellness. Let's begin connecting the dots. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Synergy Connection Show. It's Thursday morning, February the 7th, and I have Dr. Paula Nelson as my returning guest. Dr. Nelson, as you may recall from the previous show, is a licensed clinical social worker who works with those suffering from addictions and trauma. Today's show will attempt to explain the evidence-based therapeutic technique called EMDR, which stands for eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. So welcome back, Dr. Nelson. I'm so happy to have you back.
Oh, thank you for having me back, Lucy. I'm excited to talk about EMDR. EMDR is actually an eye movement therapy. It's not a talk therapy. Mm-hmm. So eye movements are actually used to stimulate the right and the left side of the brain. You follow the clinician's fingers back and forth, and you can also use tones or lights or tapping to stimulate both sides of your brain. This is so powerful because what would take me years and years of talk therapy, I can achieve in a handful of sessions of EMDR.
And it's evidence-based, as I understand, and it has been for quite a while, so...
It's one of the most researched therapeutic interventions. It was developed to treat post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Mm-hmm. It was used to treat veterans coming back from the war. And it was actually discovered by mistake. Frances Shapiro is the founder of EMDR, and she was walking one day. She was feeling a lot of distress. And she was walking through the park and her eyes were darting back and forth, and she noticed she felt some relief from the distress. So she got involved in testing this out and experimenting and using, you know, groups of people to see the effect of this. So it is one of the most researched interventions for PTSD, trauma, anxiety, panic attacks, phobias, grief, addictions, even self-esteem and performance anxiety.
So what actually happens in the brain itself? I mean, I know a little bit about EMDR, but I'm not trained in that field. Mm-hmm. And so I know basically it's taking a situation that is very painful, mm-hmm. or stressful, mm-hmm. and it moves it from wherever it currently is residing to a different part of the brain where it can be looked at more objectively. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of a good way to say it?
There's a few different theories of how it works. Of course, with the brain, no one is sure how it works. So
that's true.
There's some theories, but the notion is that when you have an experience, and I call them big T's and little T's, okay. There's big traumas such as war, rape,
automobile accidents,
natural disasters, and then there's a lot of little T's, and the little T's are all the things that happen to us when we're growing up.
So are they more like triggers as opposed to anything else?
There are little events that occur all through your life.
Okay.
A history of childhood emotional abuse or neglect. And it can be little things. I had a client whose mom redid everything she would do. If she was folding the napkins for dinner, her mom would come by and refold the napkins. So it's these little subtle things that add up to her feeling, I'm not good enough. Nothing I do is good enough. And that past affects the present. Mm. It affects every part of her life. So what happens is these experiences are translated into memories, okay? And when you're traumatized, whether it's a big T or a little T, the memory gets stuck in a part of the brain. It's like frozen.
Frozen in time, so to speak.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not updated. Right. You know, it's the little T's are kind of isolated in a part of the brain. The big T's are just frozen.
So if you were 5 years old or 18 years old or whenever where it's frozen in the brain is you're that age still.
Exactly.
Okay.
The past informs the present.
Right.
You know, so you know, that memory, you know, stuck in your brain is not being updated with new information. It's not linking to other memory networks, you know, to be updated. So, you know, there's theories. With the bilateral brain stimulation, that's that back and forth stimulation, that left and right.
It's a little bit like a metronome.
Yeah, you know, exactly like a metronome, or you can use headphones and they're alternating tones, or you can little buzzers, you know, little buzzers that you hold in your hands, and they alternate, you know, they kind of buzz, you know, your left hand, your right hand, your left hand, your right hand. They actually, interestingly enough, I know I'm kind of getting off your topic of your question.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
I saw a video where they used EMDR with an infant. They put these little paddles, these little buzzer things in his booties. Now, he's pre-verbal.
Okay.
And what had happened was he was in his car seat. He was in a car accident.
Oh.
After that, they could not get this infant back into the car seat, which was a problem because they couldn't go anywhere.
That's true.
So they put the buzzers in the booties and had him in the car seat and reduced his distress of being in that car seat. So after the EMDR, he was able to go into the car seat again. So this can be done with even pre-verbal.
You know what I'm thinking of is, you probably saw it on television, the little girl that was in the car seat and the door opened up and she was thrown out onto the road.
I didn't see
You didn't see that?
No.
It was on national news several different times, a couple weeks ago now.
Okay.
But the mother had her strapped into the car seat properly, but she was not hooked into the car seat seatbelt in the car, and so she was just in the car seat, in the back seat, and mom had evidently been distracted and not closed the door fully, and she went around a curve with somebody passing her, and the door swung open, the baby went rolling out into traffic in this car seat.
Oh my goodness.
And so fortunately, the person following her was able to stop get other people to stop. And it wasn't a high rate of speed, but it was still probably 30 miles an hour, 35. And so a situation like this, that little girl might have exactly the same kind of trauma, the little T and maybe a big T for her, as associated with the car seat.
Oh, EMDR would be perfect for her. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my.
Because, you know, what the theory of how it works is, you know, like you were saying, is that that bilateral brain stimulation moves that memory from long-term memory into working memory, and it's reprocessed, you're desensitized, and it's reprocessed properly and put back into your long-term memory.
So the way I used to explain trauma to people when I was working with them is, instead of it being literally your hand in front of your eyes where you cannot see anything but your hand, you're able to pull your hand out and look at it more objectively.
Right.
And until you can do that and look at it objectively, you're going to be triggered every single time something like that happens. Mm-hmm. So the child being placed back into the car seat is triggering, wow, I remember that accident even though I'm an infant.
Right, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. The other theory is that that eye movement, that left and right eye movement, replicates the eye movement we experience in REM sleep, which is our problem-solving phase of sleep. So that's the other theory of how this works.
Makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And
have you ever done a sleep study where you've watched them do it?
No.
I mean, it's fascinating when they look. I did some sleep study work, and when you look, when you're wired for sound, so to speak, and you see somebody that's in the process of a dream, how that it's like a EEG in a sense. It's a brainwave pattern, but you can see when it's in delta You can see when it's in problem solving. Oh. You can see when it comes into light sleep where the dreams are.
Yeah.
So it's very fascinating how that works.
That is. The other theory of how this works is that our brains are very elastic. Mm. And the concept is that EMDR changes the way the neurons in your brain communicate with one another. It's called neuroplasticity. So EMDR somehow reprograms the brain. I teach my clients extended resource processing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a version of EMDR that you can do on your own. And you can create new neuropathways. They call it extended resource processing because you can extend your own resources. So, for example, if you needed confidence to do something, if you could visualize a time when you felt very confident in yourself, you could tap that in, we call it, and that it creates a new neuropathway. So tapping, you kind of tap if your right, left, right, left on your thighs. You know,
okay.
Tap your hands on your thighs. You only do about 10 reps. So is there a resource that you're needing now? We could do some extended resource tapping. Because it'll create a new neuropathway in your brain.
Mm. I probably need a lot of them. So, wow, just to think of one.
Yeah, just think of one.
Patience.
Okay. So can you visualize a time when you were really super patient?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you kind of close your eyes and visualize that time when you were really patient, you can tap that in. So one... do about 10 sets
of those.
Mm-hmm. And then,
I don't think we can, you know, quite do 10 sets here on the show.
But then every time, you know, I suggest, I recommend to my clients to tap at least one time a day, because
mm-hmm.
it's kind of like, you know, going through the woods, you go through and you come back out and you can't really see your path.
Right, right.
But then if you take that same path every day, it creates
mm-hmm.
that clearing.
Exactly.
That's how it is. Every time you would tap in patience,
mm-hmm.
You would reinforce the creation of that new neuropathway in your brain.
Uh-huh.
So, you know.
Yeah, I'm a very visual person, so I can actually see that is the case, because
mm-hmm.
Where I used to live in Green Bay, Wisconsin, we were on a lot of property,
uh-huh.
and there was a path that went back to some wildflowers. And so after you've walked it a few times, you can see exactly where to go.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can extend your resources that
mm-hmm.
way. So that's another concept, is that EMDR reprograms our brains in the way our neurons communicate with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little more difficult to imagine, but... It works.
Yeah, no, I think it does make sense.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I talked about a little bit last week was this program that's called Inner Balance.
Mm-hmm.
And it works with heart coherence in much the same way, is that you are breathing with a mandala. And as the mandala is moving in and out, you're watching it so that you stay in green. And when you stay in green, you're doing coherent work. So the heart communicates more with the brain than the brain does with the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a process of learning that and what that feels like. And again, doing it more and more and more often. When you are stressed
mm-hmm.
Or having maybe a triggering moment, you would be able to then go into a heart coherence breathing.
Right.
That puts your heart and your brain together. So,
yeah,
might be something we talk about a little more later. But
interesting.
Yeah,
but
it's very, very beneficial,
mm-hmm.
and that's all through the HeartMath Institute out in California.
Right, right. Okay. Neat. I do a lot of the extended resource processing in the preparation stage or preparation phase of EMDR. EMDR is an 8-phase treatment.
Mm-hmm. So you gather information in the beginning.
Right, right.
Do most of the clients that come in, whether it's a couple How many are couples that are experiencing this? And or is it more an individual that comes in that goes, wow, I've got some stuff that is constantly being triggered, and maybe it is battle-related or illness-related or accident-related?
What I find is, you know, I have individuals and couples, and when I'm working with a couple, sometimes their history is interfering with the interaction, the connection in the marriage. And, you know, sometimes I'll suggest, you know, have you ever tried EMDR, you know, and do some individual sessions of EMDR. I have a client who, as a little girl, she was physically abused by her father. She, you know, was overweight. She never felt like she fit in. You know, she was the kid in class that didn't get invited to the party. You know, she was the last one to be picked for the team. And she, to self-soothe, she would go into her room and just escape into her toys and her drawings and her make-believe world.
Sure.
And that was her solace. Now, you know, that's all well and good. It was, you know, great that she found a place to self-soothe, but because of this history of abuse, mental, emotional, physical abuse in her childhood, today in her marriage, she's unable to share and connect with her husband. And her husband feels, you know, detached and you know, you never turn to me. And so he feels, you know, I'm unlovable, I don't matter, I'm not important, because when she is hurt or needs, you know, some nurturing,
she doesn't come to me.
She isolates.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, so, you know, we did some EMDR with her to heal that history of, you know, abuse, and so she can learn how to reach out and connect with her husband.
And by her reaching out, then he feels important again.
Right, right. And connected and attached.
Right,
So that, yeah, the past informs the present.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
How long does EMDR take, you know, when you've actually begun the process? I know you mentioned 8 sessions. Do you begin to see some benefit early on, or do you have to do the whole 8 sessions before you see results?
Actually, the research shows 12 sessions are the most effective to prevent relapse in the future for long-lasting results. So it takes, you know, a couple sessions just to get history and to figure out what we're targeting. So, you know, and I'll talk a little bit more about targets, but a typical EMDR session lasts, you know, an hour, hour and a half, and it really depends on the type of problem and the amount of previous trauma that's involved as to how long it'll take. If we're working with one memory network, and I'll talk about memory networks too, if we're talking about one simple memory network, about 12 sessions will be sufficient to prevent relapse back to those symptoms that caused the problems to begin with.
So what is one network?
Okay, so all memories are patterns of neural networks in our brain. So one neural network can be connected to another and another and another. So just like a smell, a certain smell can bring to mind various different memories.
Right, good and bad.
Right, right. They're differing neural networks or memory networks.
Right.
A disturbing event in a memory network is called the target in EMDR processing. That's what we target. That's what we work on. So for example, I had a client whose mother was alcoholic and left her at kindergarten, forgot to pick her up at kindergarten. So, you know, this little girl is watching everyone leave with their moms and get on the buses, and she's left there all by herself. Now, the kindergarten was not even in the town in which she lived, so she had no idea of where she was, what to do. She panicked. And so now she has that memory isolated from updating, okay? And the memory becomes verbalized as a belief.
Okay. That mom has forgotten me.
The belief turns into a life script, exactly, mm-hmm. Or one's expectation, right. You know, in a given situation. So being left in kindergarten developed into that life script of, I'm abandoned. People are always going to leave me. Mm. Okay, so that's a memory network. I'm abandoned.
And the target would be abandonment?
It would be being left at kindergarten. Being we left would at process, kindergarten. Yeah, okay. The being left at
so
kindergarten.
So she would have to go back in her memory bank to mm-hmm. when she was approximately 5 years old.
Right.
And try to remember that. Mm-hmm. And then the desensitization would be the movement of the eye back and forth as she's talking
right.
about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right, exactly. So when we work with a memory network, we work with past, current, and future experiences. Okay, they call this the three-pronged approach.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, using the client left at kindergarten, that would be the past incident, being left forgotten by mom at kindergarten. A current situation, what brought her in was actually she had a fight with a friend. And it was really disturbing to her. And when we did EMDR on the current situation, actually, it brought up the past memory
mm-hmm.
of, oh my gosh, you know, I was left at kindergarten. This is how I feel. I'm feeling like I'm being left by my friend. So, you know, we try to target the past first because that's the biggest bang for your buck. So, you know, in proper processing, we would process the kindergarten incident and then the friend incident and then imagining a future incident. You know, what would being abandoned look like in the future? You know, it might be losing her husband,
mm-hmm.
you know, even maybe her husband dying,
mm-hmm.
you know, and her feeling abandoned
mm-hmm.
by another person in her life. So we process past, present, and future incidents of I'm abandoned.
You know, I'm thinking especially of couples that are older couples. Quite often, mm-hmm. Whoever dies first, and in many cases, it is the man, I think, that would die before
yeah.
the female,
mm-hmm.
just longevity. Wise.
Right.
But how many times, if they don't get into a new relationship within, let's say, 6 months to a year,
mm-hmm.
the other couple dies. And
right.
they talk about it as dying of a broken heart, but it also could be a situation like this,
mm-hmm.
where the trauma of death triggers that childhood sense of abandonment,
mm-hmm.
and you know the person is just not strong enough to will themselves to continue.
Right.
Hmm.
Yeah.
My parents are both deceased, and I was told by somebody a couple of years ago, actually, in a psychic reading, that they had a pact with one another as they came into their lives
mm-hmm.
in human life, that they would leave. Pretty much together,
mm-hmm.
and that my mother was very upset with my dad leaving first.
Oh gosh!
And she happened to be in a nursing home at the time of his death, but they were able to spend those last days together mm-hmm. because the hospital brought my dad to the nursing home,
yeah.
and
yeah.
so they were able to be together. But
mm-hmm.
I thought about that after the fact, and like, I wonder how that does work if they actually. You know, in that spirit form, go, wait a minute, you agreed to leave with me. What do you mean leaving early?
Well, I made a deal with my husband. He's actually younger than me, and I made a deal with him that I go first, and he could go the day after, but I'm going first. So, because I have, you know, obviously my memory network that would be triggered would be abandonment. I've got, you know, a history of abandonment as well.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, that's the deal.
Oh, goodness.
But there's many other memory networks.
Mm-hmm.
There's the I'm not good enough. I see this a lot. I'm not good enough. I'm inadequate. I'm not worth it. Because...
How do you help them besides EMDR? I mean, if I'm a talk therapist,
uh-huh.
and so
uh-huh.
I pick up on more of the language that's used
mm-hmm.
and the emotional content behind the language. So with EMDR, since you're not doing a lot of talking and you're having the client basically relive the memories and do the eye exercise, do they begin to put two and two together? You know, can they actually begin to see, aha, now I understand that relationship and why it's triggering this?
Right. Exactly. That's the memory network starts combining with other memory networks at times as well when it's activated. And
so, are they going down new neural pathways, or the old ones and understanding the old ones better?
A kind of a combination, and again, no one really knows, but what I've seen is a combination. I try to keep people focused on the target. However, the image will change. You know, for example, the woman I was working with whose mom had left her in kindergarten. When we were processing, the image changed, and she remembered there was a teacher staying with her. So she was like, I wasn't alone. Oh. There was a teacher there.
And she didn't remember the teacher.
She didn't remember the teacher until we processed. And so that neural network was updated. It combined. Remember I was saying how when you have a trauma, that trauma is put into memory and it's isolated from, you know, the other neural networks that could update. You know, so it kind of opens up that neural network and it's updated. It was like more information came in from the past. Like, oh, I remember this. So that happens a lot when I'm processing past experiences. Like, oh my gosh, you know, I didn't see it that way. And oh, this happened too. And I forgot about that.
To me, it's so totally amazing that, you know, from that infant that was in the car accident that was having trouble getting back into the infant seat, probably from the moment of birth, because nobody has an unscathed history. We all have things.
I always say that. No, yeah. We don't get out unscathed.
No, we just don't. Yeah. So, I mean, from infancy on, we were tucking these little tiny memories of this hurt, or I didn't like this, or this made me sad, or this did whatever, and so we've got all of these messy memories that we've tucked into little corners of our brain that come back and bite us big time.
Because they these memories become beliefs and life scripts. I was just reading this book and I had to keep putting it down because it's just too much. It's called Parenting from the Inside Out, and it had an example. It's talking about attachment styles. And it had an example of when you're a baby, okay, and you have a wet diaper, and this is, you know, this isn't even a trauma, you know, this is like you're a baby, you have a wet diaper. Mom comes, you know, so she's doing all the right things. Mom responds to your crying, okay. And but she doesn't get that you have a wet diaper, so she tries to play with you, and you're frustrated because it's like, this is pre-verbal,
right?
I've got a wet diaper. What does it matter? Why are you not hearing me? Why are you not understanding me? And then mom tries to feed you instead of changing the diaper. And it's more of the
frustration.
You become disorganized, and it's like, I am unable to attach with this person. So even in the best case scenario where you cry and mom comes, there's a disconnect there where you learn as an infant right then and there, I can't trust this person to take care of me.
Right.
And, you know, so when I started reading that book, like I said, I had to put it down because I'm thinking, we're not even dealing with trauma here, and these are these little memories that can go wrong that I can't trust people, I can't attach.
Right, because if I attach, I'm going to be let down.
They don't get me.
I bet there are more relationships than not that run down that road. And look how many divorces or separations or whatever it might be that we could prevent just by maybe helping people understand that we do tuck all of these different memories into crevices where they're not dealt with. And then, like I said, they come back and they bite us at some point, you know, maybe as an older child, maybe in our teenage years, maybe in a marriage or a relationship, and we don't know how to fix it.
Right.
What happens is we keep running away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, this doesn't feel good anymore. I'm moving on.
Right, right. You know, the other thing we do, again, you know, is, you know, the opposite where you know, this is how I am, you know, and, you know, if you can't accept, you know, how I am, then, you know, sorry for your luck. You know, that happens
right,
a lot in
relationships. Right.
You know, this is just, you know, how I am.
And, you know, I hear that from both guys and gals. I mean, a long time ago, I think gals took the position of, no, let me get in there and fix things. Because they were basically more nurturers.
Right.
But anymore, I mean, with young people, I hear that big time where it's just like, if you can't accept me for who I am, oh well.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's time to move on. And yet, the very thing that none of us do a very good job with is that whole communication.
Right.
And, you know, that I see more and more as a problem because we are into our devices, whether it's the phone or the computer or whatever it might be, that, you know, a game. The,
right.
I imagine you're seeing with addictions with people that actually have video game addiction now, or phone addiction. I don't know whether they're coming in with that.
Yeah. Yeah. John Gottman calls the, I think I had mentioned this in the previous show, that John Gottman calls our phone the new affair partner.
Well, and, I mean, it's so sad. When I was traveling this summer, we took a road trip. And, you know, it was the three of us are really good friends. And so we talk all the time. But when we would be in restaurants that would be historical restaurants in some cases where there was entertainment, you could look around and see history. People were not even talking to each other.
Yeah.
They were on their devices. And it was texting.
Right,
and
right.
I was thinking, oh my goodness, you are missing so much that's going on right around you because you can't see, you know, beyond your phone.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's that is the new addiction. I'm sure it'll become a DSM-5 code someday.
I'll be doing EMDR on it because I do use the EMDR with addictions as well. You know, that they found that it can be effective in reducing the level of urge to use.
Sure, sure.
I worked with a man who, come 4 o'clock, 4 o'clock, it was his time to start drinking. You know, he would get home from work and that's the first thing he would do. So that was his trigger, was the time. It was 4 o'clock. So we used EMDR to reduce his level of urge to use at 4 o'clock. And with EMDR, you know, address the distress, but then you install a positive image or self message. So we installed a positive image of him coming home and doing other things that he enjoyed doing rather than fixing that drink.
I always had to laugh when I was living in Wisconsin. It was known as, actually it was Green Bay, but it was known as the town of the five B's, like in Boy. And it was for bingo, brats, bowling, beer, and brandy. And I always thought that was so interesting, you know, how they labeled themselves that. But, you know, I do believe that addictions, I think, would be beautifully managed by EMDR because the addiction almost always is because of an unmet need. And whether it's normally emotional, but, you know, if I'm not feeling good about myself, the way I soothe myself is to eat or drink or smoke or do drugs.
Right.
And so you've got four right there. And if you can go back to the root of where that memory was planted.
Right.
And then do the EMDR to help reduce that trigger. You've moved in a better direction.
True, because, you know, unfortunately, underneath the addiction, most addicts have been traumatized. You know, there's a history of trauma there. So if you can get underneath, you know, the level of urge to use addresses triggers, but if you can go deeper, like you were just saying, you can get underneath that, back to the past trauma, you'll have more impact.
Have they tried this? One of my clients from many years ago had 17 personalities. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole different, you know, issue altogether. But she had been sexually molested from the time she was 6 until she was 15. And so each personality came out to handle different situations in her life as she grew up. But I wonder, have they tried EMDR with personality disorders?
They have.
Successfully?
They have.
Yeah, I would think.
There's a woman that she's my mentor, actually, and that's her thing. She works a lot with DID, the multiple personalities, and dissociation. And, you know, so, yeah, that's her specialty.
I probably should have learned that style when I was working with her because...
Oh, my goodness, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, there were times... I worked with her for about 2.5 years, which is very, very long, because most of them will not trust you that long to stay with you.
You had a good...
had a very good relationship with her. The little girl loved to come in and talk, and but there was a teenager that was about 17 or 18 that really didn't like me. And when she came, I always kind of watched how close I was to the door just in case I had to make a, you know, leap for it, because she was twice my size and she could have done some serious harm, you know, as a teenager going after me.
Yeah.
But she never did. But this was so strange. A lot of people that haven't worked with dissociative personalities, they can change their eye color. And there would be moments when, where she would come in with beautiful blue eyes. Another time she'd come in with brown eyes.
My goodness.
And so that always told me who she was.
And that talks about the power of the brain.
Yes. Yes, it does.
To be able to change your eye color. Yikes.
You wonder what else our brains are capable of doing that we have no idea.
We have no idea. You know, getting back to what we were talking about with the little things that happen throughout our lives that aren't even traumas. I had a man come in to work with me because he had low self-esteem, and EMDR can be is great for that. Because of all the incidents of I'm not good enough when you're a kid growing up. And when we were, you know, taking history and talking about it, now he was probably in his 60s and suffering from low self-esteem, which, you know, affected all of his relationships, you know, professionally, personally.
Oh, I was going to say, every way.
Yeah. And as I was taking history, he said, you know, my mom always used to say, you're just like your dad. You're just like your dad. Hmm. You know, we do that to our kids. And I was thinking, so what's wrong with that? You know? And he said, but she couldn't stand my dad.
Oh.
And I was like, oh my goodness.
So that meant you can't stand me.
Right.
And how many times, I mean, I think people say it very laughingly, but I see this on Facebook quite a bit where... a mother will say to a child, I hope you have children just like you.
Yeah. So my mom said that to me.
To you. You know, and then you think, well, if I was such a bad kid, I don't want to have, you know, children that are like me. And then you kind of turn around and you already are gifting them with your behavior.
Right. Yeah, that life script. Yep. You're passing on your life script.
Oh my goodness, we gotta learn to stop doing that.
I know. Oh my goodness. So, you know, there's you know, the 8 phases of EMDR.
Okay.
And it begins with the history taking and the treatment planning, you know, trying to identify those targets.
And they in turn agree, I'm sure, with you as to, yes, this is target number one, because it'll make the most difference. So they're working conjointly with you.
Right. Then there's the prep, the history and the treatment planning is maybe 1 or 2 sessions. The preparation can take 2 to 4 sessions depending on the history of trauma. You know, but going back to the diagnosis, when you were talking about the multiple personalities, they don't normally use EMDR for schizophrenia, and there's some question about bipolar disorder as well. So they're still exploring, you know, working with bipolar disorder, but it doesn't work well with schizophrenia. So it depends on the diagnosis, how much preparation is going to be involved.
Does that in part depend on the chemical imbalance then? Because in some emotional diagnoses, it is a, like you were referring to it as a target. It is a situation that did occur that they have then written a script around that says this is who I am. In other cases, like bipolar disease, it really is a chemical imbalance. And trying to get that somewhat level, I would think EMDR doesn't relate as well. It just, it simply can't go there because it's not dealing with chemistry as much as it's dealing with incidents.
You know, and I agree with you because I, you know, I know that EMDR is often used to treat depression. Now, I think if the depression is
caused by an incident,
it'll work. But if it's strictly, you know, the biochemical piece, I haven't had success.
And so it becomes the job of the clinician in your case to make sure that you have the diagnosis down and to knowing whether it's an incident related or whether it's a chemical relationship.
You know, so during the preparation stage phase, you develop a lot of calming resources to help the client through the process. So that extended resource processing will develop extended resources such as a protector figure. You know, when you think of a protector figure, what do you think of? And it can be imaginary, it can be a person, it can be, you know, I had a client who used guardian angel, you know, as a protector figure. And in processing, if a client becomes too activated, I'll say, you know, let's bring in your protector figure to help you with that.
Right.
You know, so
what if they have like a pet? I'm thinking of therapy dogs in particular, but
that would be great.
Yeah, but if they had a cat or a dog or, you know, an animal that they actually were receiving nurturing from, you know, that then is a substitute instead of you being able to nurture yourself.
Yeah.
You know, the animal then provides that while you're working through this.
Right. We will bring in a nurturing figure, usually a protector figure, a nurturing figure, a wise figure, and then that calm, peaceful place just to help move through. Because sometimes as you're processing, and you can't do this wrong, your brain just does it. You know, like I'll have clients say, am I doing this right? Am I doing this right? And it's like, you can't do this wrong. Your brain is going to do what it does. Let's just go with it, you know.
It's kind of like breathing.
Yeah, exactly. But sometimes you get stuck. You know, your brain will just block because it feels afraid to process. And that's when we can bring in that nurturing pet or, you know, like, what do you need to help you? What will help
See,
you?
See, like a wise turtle walking in and saying, here, walk with me. You will be okay,
Yeah. You know, of course, I've had clients who have said, you know, I want it to be, you know, my mom. And it's like, you know, let's think of something else because, you know, this
moms can have baggage.
You know, so we might see some connections to mom in the past, so the pet is better.
I'm gonna have you pause for 1 second because I want you to be able to let people know how they can find you. I'm sure they're finding a lot of this very informative, and maybe they're relating to some of what we're saying. So if that is the case, why don't you tell them your phone number and how they can locate you?
Thank you.
And we'll do it now rather than at the end of the show.
Okay. I'm located in Dunedin, Florida, at Bayshore Michigan Boulevards, and I'm Dr. Paula Nelson. My phone number, just Paula is good. My phone number is 813-951-8889.
Okay. And they can leave a message if... Or do you have a receptionist there that takes care of your calls for you?
It's just me. They just could you? Leave a message and I'll get back. I'm a little OCD about getting back to people. If I'm in session, I'll get back to you in between sessions. That's also my cell phone. So people can text me.
Oh, okay.
And
why don't you give it one more time?
It's 813-951-8889.
Okay.
Thanks.
You're welcome. I just, I think there's a lot of people, like I said, that probably would benefit from something like EMDR and may have a number of stumbling blocks in their lives that could be smoothed out. So going back to the assessment,
This is where we select the image to target. And you know, going back to my client who was left at kindergarten, I'll ask the client to bring up that image, you know, of being that little girl left at kindergarten, and then choose a statement that expresses a negative self-belief. You know, for her, it's I'm abandoned. I'm alone. I'm abandoned. You know, oftentimes it's the I'm not good enough. I'm unlovable. I'm worthless. I'm bad. You know, when people have a lot of guilt, you know, there's that underlying I'm bad. And then we'll rate that. On a scale of 0 to 10, your level of disturbance, you know, on a scale of 0 to 10, how much do you believe that you're abandoned when you bring up that image? 10 being, yes, I'm abandoned, I'm totally alone in this world. 0, no, I'm fine, you know. So we rate that and then pick a positive self-statement that you want to replace, you know, instead of I'm alone, I'm abandoned. It could be, you know, I have support. You know, I'm not alone. It could be as simple as I'm not alone.
Or even just I have coping skills. You know, there are things I can do to manage this.
Yeah. And then we rate that. When you bring up that image, you know, how much do you believe that on a scale of 1 to 7?
Do they kind of assess every session then at the end of the session so they can see their progress?
Yeah, what we do when they come back is it's called reevaluation. We'll bring that up, bring up that image and see what that level of distress is. And if there's anything left, if it, you know, sometimes it's, you know, a 9 to begin with, and then they'll come back the next session. You know, maybe it's like a 2.
Okay.
We'll go in and clear that out.
Okay. So it's like continual tidying up.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you ever had somebody in the very beginning of your sessions that maybe had a panic attack, you know, like this little girl kind of reliving that moment, you know, that all of a sudden the breathing becomes distressed, or, you know, they have heart palpitations?
That's a good question. It's happened.
Has it?
Yes. And we'll either go with that if the person's able to, you know, because that's what we do, is like we do these repetitions of the bilateral brain stimulation. We'll either go with that, or I'll say, all right, let's tap in your calm place and, you know, bring it down a bit, you know, the level of distress. So, and then continue on. But, you know, with EMDR, the client is always in control, as opposed to hypnosis.
Right.
That, you know, I tell my clients, if you want to stop, just you say, I'm stopping, you know, we're good. I'm good with that, you know. So that's the nice thing about, a couple nice things about EMDR is, you have total, the client has total control, and you don't have to keep talking about the traumatic incident. You just visualize it in your mind. You don't have to repeat it all to me, so you're not re-traumatized by telling the story again.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's nice.
I think whenever, especially with therapy, because it's a little bit like going in for a physical, you're undressed. You know, and except you're undressed emotionally.
Yeah.
So, you know, it allows them to feel like they have some, at least a little bit of control over how much they reveal, how much they want to share.
Right.
And so as they feel more on top of it, they probably can share more because they know, oh, I'm not going to lose it.
Right.
You know, I can process this and talk about it.
That's true. you know, at the end of the session, we do a body scan because they, you know, trauma is held in the body.
Right. How many people hold it in their shoulders and neck?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, either the shoulders and neck or the core.
Yeah.
You know,
or,
yeah.
Upset stomachs. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we kind of do a body scan to see, you know, how you're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's anything there, we'll continue processing. But normally people feel, you know, a sense of relaxation, and there's what I found is that there's immediate relief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even one session of EMDR, people will come in and start, you know, at a high level of distress and feel so much better afterwards. Because the other thing is that the bilateral eye movement creates serotonin in your brain, your own feel-good neurotransmitter.
Mm-hmm.
That's the neurotransmitter that's, you know, elicited when you eat.
Right.
You know, when you're hungry and you kind of feel hangry, you know, and then when you eat, you're like, ah, I'm good, you know.
You know, I was just speaking with someone yesterday whose daughter has Prader-Willi disease. I don't know whether you know much about it. But
I have no idea. What is
what
that?
What Prader-Willi is?
Yeah.
Oh, it's kind of complicated, but it is now being diagnosed at birth. They have a way of diagnosing it, whereas before they didn't get it diagnosed until usually around age 10 or 11. But one of the symptoms is feeling hungry all the time.
Oh my goodness.
And what they
horrible.
Yeah, and what they've discovered is the serotonin works on these Prader-Willi patients.
Oh my
goodness. Know, whether they're, because if they're young, and they just know they're hungry. And so they become very demanding. Because it's, you know, like, I need to eat. And if the lunch isn't on the table, breakfast isn't on the table, dinner isn't
that's
on the table, it's very tough for the whole family. And they have to have more protein.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to really watch their sugar intake. Many of them are gluten intolerant. And so the family has the disease right along with the child.
Mm-hmm.
And up until very recently, they have very little that they can do to kind of help. It's more coping mechanisms than it is actual cure or treatment. But they're getting closer and closer to treatments now.
Oh my gosh.
When you talked about serotonin, that is one of the things, because it is the feel-good hormone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what happens during pregnancy. And it also is a way for these particular patients to control their hunger urges. So it's interesting how all of these brain chemicals that we're just kind of realizing how it can be used to treat so many different areas in life.
When I had my private practice up in Delaware, I specialized in eating disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And I found research that said when people binge and purge, you know, like, no one can understand, why would you make yourself vomit?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what they did was they did spinal taps. And they found that when you make yourself vomit, it creates serotonin in your brain.
Okay.
So that's why it was such a relief.
So it's almost like getting a high from doing something like vomiting.
Yeah. I thought that was fascinating.
Interesting.
I know that that's totally off the topic. But
yeah. Well, it all relates to, you know, just how we do process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so much is still unknown.
You know,
it's not just a matter of you're born, you grow up, you get married, you have kids, you get old, you die.
Right.
You know, there's so much in between. And, you know, they refer to that sometimes as the dash, you know, from birth to death. But it's how you want to live that dash.
And
if you don't know how to live it because you have these different triggers that are tucked into the crevices again of the brain, this might be a way, you know, EMDR might be a way to process that so that you live, as I refer to it, your best life. You can live a more fulfilling, love-filled, joy-filled existence. Interesting.
I find that in my couples counseling, so much of the conflict relates back to our childhood histories. You know,
and you referred to earlier as attachments that, you know, sometimes it's the attachments that maybe were not healthy ones. if I understand.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of study on attachment style, mm-hmm. you know, and there's the secure attachment where you learn that if you cry, you know, your mom is going to be there. It's usually the mom. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mom's going to be there consistently and give you what you need. And if it's a wet diaper, they're going to know it's your wet diaper. And then there's the avoidant attachment style where mom isn't really attaching. You can cry and she's not coming. And you have to learn how to manage yourself.
So it's more like self-soothing mm-hmm. that has to take mm-hmm. place, and you become more independent.
Totally independent.
But at the same time, then, relationships might be extremely difficult as right. you go through life mm-hmm. because you don't like that
attachment
mm-hmm. you know, that somebody may have.
It's going to feel controlling, suffocating, mm-hmm. you know, because you have learned to function on your own, and that's your norm, and that's what you're used to. And then if someone wants to get closer, it feels like they're trying to control you. It's scary.
I would wonder if, you know, in situations like that, if you know, I don't know, maybe the relationship between spouses, I'm thinking even parent-child, do they ever get that resolved where, you know, where they can actually be in a healthy, loving, supported relationship? Mm-hmm. Or if for their entire life it's going to be, now, you know, I'm thinking of people who didn't have a father figure mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. their life. You see a lot of these with athletes.
Right.
And they always saying hi mom from the sidelines. Yeah. Football players in particular do that. Mm-hmm. But they didn't really have maybe that father figure in their life mm-hmm. ever, or maybe not until late in life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, their lifetime might be devoted to being, you know, the father that they didn't have.
Right.
But there's something missing mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. their psyche.
Yeah.
You know, that
yeah.
they didn't have that nurturing. So they don't really know how to nurture, you know, somebody else. They only know how to maybe, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's difficult. You know, and I'll talk fast because I know we're almost out of time, but I have a client who didn't get what she needed as a kid. You know, her parents were there, but they were busy and they had some difficulties themselves, so she didn't get that love and nurturing that she needed as a kid consistently. Mm-hmm. And so she learned how to become a really independent little girl. And now in her relationship, she's unable to attach. And anytime her significant other tries to connect with her, she feels like he's trying to control her, and mm. she runs. She just shuts down. She runs. And it's really difficult to heal. Now, knowing about attachment style we've been talking about is helping her to look at this now and maybe see her part in it, mm-hmm. because she felt it was him. He's controlling. So now with this information on attachment style and her looking at her family system, she's making small shifts and trying to connect with him and change her perception of him trying to control her.
Right.
But I think it's the information and the insight and owning a piece of it.
Right. I know I've always talked about, and I think maybe we even talked about this before, but in relationships, that if people look at it as a triangle, because the triangle is the strongest shape, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. more so than squares or circles or anything else, the triangle is really strong. And they use that triangle in building bridges, interestingly enough, mm-hmm. As they build.
Right.
But if the two corners of the triangle are trust and respect, mm-hmm. you know, that's part of what communication is. So if
right.
I trust you, mm-hmm. then I can bring anything to you because I know you're going to give me that sacred space that we've talked about.
Right, right.
And if I respect you, I listen to you. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I don't listen to you if I don't have those two. I
right.
can't get from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sort of thinking that communication, like with the person you spoke about, mm-hmm. you know, as she's looking at her part in it,
right?
She also has got to be willing to open up mm-hmm. and talk mm-hmm. about where some of those beliefs, mm-hmm. you know, reside in her thinking,
right?
So that she can get further down the road. And I quite often in workshops that I've done, I said, you know, when you're pointing a finger at anybody, whether it's a verbal point, you have three pointing back at you. I mean, if you think of it in terms of the pointer finger going out and recognizing that, hey, there's always three coming back. So what part do you have in this process? Right. And that's important for them to recognize. Wow, I can't believe how the time flew. So thank you, Dr. Nelson.
Thank you.
And I know you'll be back again, and we'll have other wonderful things to talk about. I hope everyone has just a beautiful day out there. It's gorgeous outside. I think it's supposed to be about 80. And anybody who you feel needs to listen to this show, please go to SynergyConnectionRadio.com. The show will be up and archived a little bit later this afternoon. Everybody go out there and make it your best day. Thank you so much.
Thank you.